and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our daily coverage of the 2018 Iditarod here on Mushing Radio. You can find all of our episodes over on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts. We're on social media at DogWorks Radio, and you can find us online at dogworksradio.com. And I am joined today by my co-host, Alex Stein, calling in from Southern California. Alex, how is it going?
It's going great, Robert. And, you know, we were talking a couple days ago about when the last team would come in. And if your answer was this morning, Saturday morning, you would be right. We had Meredith Mapes came in early this morning. And then within 20 minutes, the last three teams, Jason Stewart, Anya Rodano, and Red Lantern Magnus Kaltenborn, who also is Norwegian, came in right around 10 of 11 until about 11:15.
Excellent. About a day ahead of time, which is great. Can you tell our listeners that may be listening to the first time, first off, what is the Red Lantern and why do they give it? And maybe tell us a little bit about the Widow's Lamp as well, if you could.
Sure. So the Red Lantern is an award that traditionally is given to the last place finisher in, I believe, most sled dog races, or at least most mid-distance and long-distance sled dog races. It's a tradition in the Iditarod, and literally you get a red lantern, a trophy with a red lantern on it. Sometimes when the Red Lantern team is coming down Front Street in Nome, someone will actually bring a red lantern out to them so that when they're coming down the street and finishing, they can take it. It is a, you know, it's both a prize that people like to win and that fans like to talk about. And it's also a prize that I don't think you actually, when you're setting out to run the race, think to yourself, oh, I hope that I get this prize. So it is definitely a symbol of perseverance. We've said many times that it is a big challenge just to complete a race like Iditarod. And it is absolutely nothing to ever be ashamed of, whether you are in first place or in the Red Lantern position. Anyone who finishes the Iditarod has achieved something that is enormous and that the vast majority of people on Earth will never know what it's like. So congratulations to Magnus. It's also, you know, I like to look at these things in terms of patterns and symmetry, and it is a little bit oddly appropriate that we have a Norwegian both at the front and at the rear of the pack. And Magnus Kaltenborn also said that he was someone who was very inspired by watching Robert Sorley when Robert Sorley and that version of Team Norway were so dominant in the early 2000s. So very cool to see Magnus coming in as the Red Lantern. Separate from the Red Lantern is something called the Widow's Lamp, which we've talked about in the past. And the Widow's Lamp is a light. These days it's a lantern that is mounted on the burled arch, and it stays there all of the time while there are competitors and teams on the trail. And then when the Red Lantern comes in, after he or she is checked in and officially finishes, there's a little presentation and a little observation and custom where they take the widow's lamp down from the burled arch and they bring it over to the Red Lantern winner, and the Red Lantern winner extinguishes the widow's lamp, and that is the official end of the Iditarod race. So it's, you know, we've talked in the past that it goes back to this idea of leaving lanterns in the windows of roadhouses, often very remote roadhouses, when there were people coming in. And it is a symbol in Iditarod that there are still mushers who are on their way into the finish. And as long as they are on the trail, the widow's lamp will stay lit.
And I'm sure you know this, Alex, but there's also a very large star that's, I guess it would be east of Anchorage on the Glen Highway as you're heading to the Matsu Valley. That star is lit right around Christmas time, you know, for the Christmas season, and it stays on all the way until that Red Lantern finisher comes across in Iditarod, and then they turn it off that evening. So, yeah, there's not only the Red Lanterns and the Widow's Lamps, but also a really cool star here in the Anchorage area. And I think it's probably, what, maybe a couple hundred feet across. It's a pretty big star out there, isn't it?
Yeah, and when you're driving by or when you're in nearby, it's definitely something that is very visible and something that you can see. And it's always been a very cool thing for me that that is there as a reminder that the race is going on.
And it's just a privately owned thing. It's not, you know, it's not done by the Park Service or anything like that. It's just some guy up there at his property that lights that. And I think that's a cool homage to not only the holidays, of course, but also to those Iditarod mushers as well. So what's on tap for some stories today? I know that things are winding down, at least in terms of news coverage and that sort of thing. We have the banquet tomorrow, but I understand you have a little bit more of an update on the Jim Lanier rescue yesterday. Is that right?
So we're getting some more details about what happened when Jim veered off course. And it looks like from going over the tracker, which has a history thing. So going over the history in the tracker, that he went almost all the way out to the coast, was seemingly discombobulated, didn't know which way was which, took a wrong turn, went almost all the way to the coast, then came back. And apparently when he was on his way back to the trail, he was in such intense winds that his sled got trapped by a very large rock. So he couldn't get his sled free. Apparently he had been there for several hours by the time Scott Jansen came by. And Scott said that he just happened to look in that direction. And if he hadn't looked in that direction, he would have just gone by, which is what seems to have happened with several other mushers who were very close to him, but because of the wind, couldn't hear him and couldn't see him, and just went by. So Scott parked his dog, went over to help Jim, was able to get the sled free, but then wasn't able to get the dogs moving again. And, you know, we've talked about this on many occasions, but when the dogs don't want to move, the dogs don't want to move, and there's not a lot you can do about it. So they were there together for several more hours, talking to each other, trying to keep each other warm. They activated the GPS emergency signal. Apparently, shortly thereafter, a couple of bicycle riders on fat tire bikes came by, and by this time, Scott was also starting to get hypothermia. He had a satellite phone and was trying to dial his wife on the satellite phone, but he wasn't able to have his fingers work well enough to dial her number. So they had one of the fat bike riders dial her on his satellite phone, and he told her what was going on, and she contacted Iditarod, or contacted, you know, the comms people at Iditarod or the race marshal, and then they mobilized to get Jesse Royer, who was in safety, to come out and check on them, and then mobilize the rescue. And apparently at one point, Jim Lanier said to Scott, "I don't think I'm going to make it." Scott told him, "No, you're going to be okay. We're going to get through this together," and stayed with him. And then the two of them were medevaced, and they said in this article that they were both starting to have, the wind was so intense that they were starting to have their corneas start to freeze over, which is a very dangerous kind of thing to have happen. Then they were brought back to safety. Their dogs were subsequently brought in. They were taken by helicopter from safety to Nome, treated in the helicopter. Apparently, when they got to Nome, they both declined further medical treatment because just being able to warm up and being able to get to a place where they were warm enough was enough of a start in the right direction that they were able to come off of that and be okay. But it is, you know, very, very frightening thing, and a good reminder that even for people who are very familiar with the trail and who are seasoned mushers and absolutely know what they are doing, that there is always something that can go wrong, and there are always the chances that, you know, some weather event or some natural occurrence will go very wrong and put people's lives literally at risk. So it's, you know, I continue to say that this is just an amazing, amazing story. It's such a great and wonderful thing that Scott Janssen did. And, you know, learning more about it, you realize that it was a lot more serious than maybe we had thought originally.
Wow, Alex. You know, I'm sitting here at a sled dog race here in Chugiak, and I just happened to be with Jim Lanier's handler, the person that's picking up his drop dogs and that sort of thing, and he and I are going to be racing together tonight. So first off, I want to apologize to all my sled dogs that are barking outside of my truck, but hey, we're at a sled dog race, and we're on Mushing Radio, so hopefully the fans listening don't mind a little bit of flavor. Secondly, Alex, there's a few things I want to mention about what you had just said, because I hadn't read this story yet. First off, I think that it's absolutely amazing that a person has not died yet on the Iditarod Trail. You know, we talk a lot about dogs dying on the trail and that sort of thing, and, you know, that's a big point of contention out there. But we've been running this race since the early 70s and luckily have never had anybody perish on the trail, and it sounds like this was pretty close with Jim. So I'm glad everything worked out well with him and Scott. So that's my first point. My second point is the spot trackers that they use. When you push that button, if nobody is familiar with these, especially if people aren't avid outdoors people, or, you know, they've never been in the backcountry, they probably aren't familiar with the spot tracker devices that they give to all the mushers. When you push that button, Alex, that SOS or emergency button, you have no idea if that signal went through. It doesn't give you a confirmation. It isn't a text message or anything like that. You just push a little button on a thing about the size of an old school flip phone, and you just hope that it has connected with a satellite up in the sky there and then beamed back to that emergency center where it is connected. My third point is how great it is that Scott Janssen had a satellite phone. Just last year before, that was illegal to carry. And I think that's probably what saved their lives, is having that sat phone, because obviously Scott was able to hand that off to one of the fat bikers, and they were able to call out to I believe you said Scott's wife. So how cool is that, that rule was changed a couple of years ago, and then now it has been used for exactly what it was designed for that emergency procedure. My last point I want to make, you talked about those fat bikers. At the same time that Iditarod is going on, they have a race that's happening on the same exact trail, leaving here from Anchorage and going all the way to Nome, and it is a race for fat bikers, walkers or runners or skiers or any mode of transportation other than dogs work their way up from Anchorage to Nome. And I believe, Alex, that the finisher of that fat bike race finished this week, which is absolutely amazing to ride a bike 1,000 miles and then still be on pace to catch up with these dog teams. I think that is so cool. So those are my theory on what I had mentioned.
Yeah, you know, just to reiterate what you said, the Iditarod Trail is a multi-use trail. We tend to think of it, especially those of us who are race fans, as just being a dog racing trail, but it is used certainly during the winter by all different types of people. I believe the Iron Dog, which is a snow machine race, also runs on the Iditarod Trail, although that's much faster and runs a couple of weeks before the Iditarod Sled Dog Race. But yeah, there are people who use it for walking, for biking, for skiing and skijoring. So yeah, we may think of it as being this kind of empty expanse, but it's really not. And especially for something that is as long as this is, I think it's a bit of a mistake to think of it as just being something that's empty except for the Iditarod race, because it's really
right.
It's and not only is it used by recreational people, but it's also used as a way of getting supplies in and out of the villages, and people who live in the villages going on trap lines and hunting and things like that. So it's not something that's empty. It's something that is, you know, basically a road for these people out in the middle of, out in the interior.
Right. What is your thought on the sat phone deal with Scott? You know, like I said, I think this was, it was a great use of a rule that has been frowned upon for many years before.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the timing was and whether there was a problem with getting the signal from the GPS devices, which, you know, as anyone who stayed up at night watching the GPS knows, there are just pockets where they don't work, or there's pockets where they don't work for a while. So, yeah, it's great that he was able to have this phone. It is fantastic that they were able to make contact with his wife and then make contact with the ITC and then get help to Jim and to Scott when they needed it. So, this is, as we've said a lot in the past 6 months, it seems that there are a lot of things that have gone wrong. There have been a lot of things that people are unhappy about. This is something that really very much operated the way it was supposed to.
So you have a quick story or update on Catherine Keith's dog that passed away on the trail. Is that right?
Yeah, they did the preliminary neck. How do you pronounce that word? I seem to have a mental block.
Necropsy.
Necropsy. They did the, I'm not sure why I can never remember how to pronounce that. They did the original necropsy, and it came back that the dog died of pneumonia. So there was a suspicion when the dog was brought in that the dog might have pneumonia, and that seems to be what the cause of the fatality was. And I believe there may be additional tests done on the dog later, or when it gets back to Anchorage, but that's what we're looking at. You know, as we said yesterday, the day before, it is always very, very sad when we have dog deaths. But I think that we're very, very lucky this year that there was only one. I'm at least happy. I'm trying to look at the bright side of this, and I'm at least happy that there weren't multiple dog deaths.
You know, I don't know if you know this, Alex, but in particular with the controversy with Dallas Seavey's dogs and the doping and all that went on, in most sled dog races, the head veterinarian and the veterinary team is in charge of the dogs for, at most races, I believe it's 12 hours. It could be as long as 36 hours maybe in the Iditarod, where they sort of are under control of all of the dogs in case something happens. That's very similar to going to see a specialist. You know, you may see your emergency room doctor and they do whatever they're going to do. Then all of a sudden you're under the care of a specialist for a period of time. And I think this is a great thing in all of sled dog sports that they have this continued care for not only at the end of the race. Let's say you finish your race right now, you can still receive that care for maybe a day and a half longer. And also, if anything happens, unfortunately, if a dog were to die or if a dog became seriously ill or injured, that rule is in place so that they have continued care throughout that time that the dogs are still in the race. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the dogs are still under the care of the veterinarian even after the race, whether the musher wants that or not. And I think that's a great safeguard, not only for the dogs, but for the mushers and the ITC itself. Very quickly, Alex, I know you want to talk very briefly about the banquet that's happening tomorrow. Tomorrow evening, we're going to be on probably about the same time that the banquet is going on. It goes on for several hours, and they issue a bunch of awards, and we're going to talk about each one of those awards on the show. And if we have at that time who's won those awards, we will talk about that as well. You know, the Sportsmanship Award and, you know, there are all sorts of awards, all of the awards on the trail, et cetera, et cetera. So what do you want to mention real quick about the banquet?
The banquet is just a wonderful event. It's a time for all of the mushers and their families who are up in Nome to gather together. It's a time when people come and tell trail stories. As you mentioned a few nights ago, there's no time limit. So so when the mushers start getting up and giving their speeches, they can theoretically go on for quite a while, and some of them do. And you know, they talk about things that happened to them on the trail. They talk about some of their experiences that they really liked. It's a lot smaller than the banquet in Anchorage. It's at the high school gym, and it's catered by the lakefront in Anchorage. So the chefs come up and they bring up all sorts of food. They have fresh fruit, which is, you know, very, very hard to get, to come by in Nome. And they have roast beef and chicken and, you know, all sorts of hot dishes. And it's really quite the gathering. I believe it still is not broadcast. Every year there's sort of, you know, there's an outcry that it should be on the Insider. And traditionally what happens is one of the local radio stations will broadcast the audio from the banquet, so people who are in Nome can hear it. But unfortunately, this is a station that isn't available via streaming. So unless you're actually in Nome and you can hear this, you're not able to hear what's going on. But it's kind of the last gasp for it. It starts in the early afternoon, and usually Alaska Airlines will have a special night flight the night of the banquet. Theoretically the banquet is supposed to be over by then, but it never is. So there's always an announcement from the stage that the last flight of the day, the extra flight of the day, is going to leave. And so then people who need to get back to Anchorage that night will leave the banquet and go onto this flight. But it's just a really wonderful event that seemingly almost everyone in Nome goes to, plus a lot of these people who are there just for the race.
You know, Alex, you had mentioned the flight out. If we could just take a couple of minutes, I love telling the story about the Nome Airport. I've been up there both during Iditarod and then in the off season, like in the summertime. The Nome Airport is only as large as a couple of gates at your typical airport terminal. It's not very big at all. And what I find so cool about this airport, Alex, not only during Iditarod time, but also in the off season, the locals that are flying in and out of, again, you know, an hour to an hour and a half or whatever time it is, and check their bags and do all that, and then they will go home. They will actually go home from the airport and spend an hour or so at home before their flight boards, which I think probably doesn't happen anywhere else in the country at an airport that's as busy as Nome is, especially during the winter. And then secondly, during Iditarod time, in this little teeny building, it is literally standing room only, shoulder to shoulder, packed in like sardines, of people trying to get out on these very few flights going back to Anchorage or Fairbanks or wherever they're going. And then it's one of those airports where it does not have a jetway. You walk outside no matter what the temperature. You walk across the runway, up the stairs like you did old school, and get on the flight. And then, of course, in the summertime, I was there, and, of course, I couldn't go home, so I checked in an hour and a half or whatever time ahead of time, and I was the only one there. Me and a couple of Alaska Airlines employees were the only ones there for well over an hour. They were talking about their families with me and what we did and whatnot. It's just a cool environment there at the Nome Airport that I don't think very many people get to experience. I know you have a couple of times.
Yeah, and, you know, it's the waiting area inside the terminal is very, very small. It's not that you can see how big my living room is, but I think it's probably only about twice the size of my living room. So, you know, when you pack like 85 or 100 people in there, you're in very, very close quarters.
Yeah, there's only a couple of rows of seats, maybe a vending machine or two, an old school payphone, and then the desks for the workers there, and that's about it. The little scanning machine, the TSA thing, is just in one corner, and you zip through there, and you're ushered outside. So as soon as you get your pat down, you're outside of the building in the cold and walking your way to the airplane. I just think it's such a cool experience, and maybe I'm overly dramatic here a little bit or whatever, but I love that little airport.
Yeah, and it's sort of amazing because you would think that, especially around Iditarod time when everyone is trying to get out and trying to get on flights that are overbooked, and everything kind of seems to work out. And I think the people who work there just have this almost zen attitude that things will just go well. and they almost always do, which is just wonderful to me.
Yeah, I've never seen an argument. I've never seen, a fight of any kind. I've never seen any pushing or shoving. It's just it's sort of a controlled chaos, so to speak. So anyway, excuse me, we have a couple of more Musher profiles here for this year's coverage. Who is this evening?
So this evening's Musher profile is Charlie Bania, and I know that we've talked about him a few years ago, but thought he was worth mentioning again. He's 44, born and raised in Illinois, came to Alaska in 1991, and came up again in 2006 and sort of fell in love with the idea of being a musher. He was an Iditarider in 2007, and then he worked for G.B. Jones as a handler, and got to drive the tag sled on the ceremonial start for several years. And he now splits his time between Alaska and Illinois. He's got a relatively small kennel in Kinnick, and he has 31 sled dogs, of which I believe 8 are retired, but still are there with him, and 23 are competitive sled dogs. And he is a diabetic, and he runs the race every year as a reminder that diabetes can, requires extra care, and so he has to take his insulin and his pump with him out on the trail, but that diabetes is not something that will prevent you from leading a full and complete life. This is his 6th Iditarod. He has 4 finishes now. His best finish was 34th place in 2015. He finished this year in 35th place, did very, very well. But the other reason I wanted to talk about him is kind of a one-man band at his kennel. So a lot of kennels, even small kennels, they'll have like a couple of people who are splitting the kennel chores, or they'll have, you know, a musher will have his spouse or kids who are helping out. But Charlie basically is the guy who is doing everything at his kennel, which is kind of an amazing thing that is a bit of a throwback perhaps to the way things used to be, is very, very unusual in this day and age. And the other thing is, like a lot of people, this year he had shipped a second sled to McGrath. And when he got to McGrath, he decided that he didn't want to take the sled that he'd shipped there, that the sled he was running on would be better. And then as he was going into Roan, his sled basically started falling apart a little bit. So he said that he was coming into Roan and he's about halfway there and the team is doing very, very well. In fact, the team is going faster than he wants them to go. And he starts trying to brake and is pushing down on the brake because there are a lot of turns. And he's thinking there's something weird happening with this brake. It doesn't seem to be going down all the way. And he looked down and he saw that his brake was cracked. So he was trying to use what he thought was a full brake, and it was only like a half or a third of the brake. And he got to Roan, he thought about scratching, and then he managed to jury-rig a replacement brake system that worked for a little while, but then stopped working as well as he wanted it to work. Then when he was leaving Finger Lake, the stanchion on his sled broke, and he said that he basically was didn't have any good way of steering the sled, so basically was steering the sled just by using all of the different muscles in his legs and in his arms and wading into the turns and trying to avoid trees, although there were several trees that he said that he wound up hitting. And, by the time this was in Roan, and by the time he got to McGrath, he chose to keep going with this sled because he had figured out a way to make it work, and to sort of improvise with having this sled work that was falling apart, but that he had figured out how to operate. And, you know, we talk a lot about how things go wrong when you're on the trail and you have to figure out ways to make things work. So I thought that was a really great story about someone who literally has to reinvent in his mind how he's going to steer and how he's going to brake and use various parts of his sled because things have just gone a little bit wrong.
And then he had, 600 miles or so to go with that sled because he chose to leave his second sled behind, which is absolutely remarkable, where he may have had a purely functional sled that he left back there and chose to continue. You know, what's interesting about Charlie is I had him on Mushing Radio a couple of years ago when they ran the Fairbanks route. It was the first one, what was that, 3 or 4 years ago. But that was the time where they had faced nearly 60 degrees below zero temperatures out on the Iditarod Trail from, I believe it was like from Manly to Ruby and that section of the trail, very, very cold. And you had mentioned that he was a diabetic. And one of the things that was on top of his mind was being able to keep his insulin warm from freezing. Obviously, that's a very, very important thing for him, a life-threatening condition if it were to go awry. And I wanted to bring this up, not only one, was it absolutely amazing that he was able to do so in such temperatures? But I know on our show here, we had just finished up a couple of months ago our season about the Serum Run. And that was a big task for all of those mushers as they were working their way down the trail on the relay, was making sure that diphtheria serum was kept warm. And I think it's an interesting parallel in stories that not only did they do it way back in 1925, but they also did it almost 100 years later on the exact same trail that they were running that year with Charlie there on the rivers from Manly to Ruby and then on up and catching the trail that it is today. I just think it's a cool parallel between the two stories that provides ways of keeping life-saving medications warm on the same trail, and they struggled to do that almost 100 years apart.
Yeah, it's a very cool parallel. The other great thing that Charlie did is, and I don't know if, why this was available, but his website is iditaradmusher.com. So, you know, apparently either no one had thought to register that domain or someone had it and let it lapse, but that is a great and very memorable domain name to have. So, you know, if you want to learn more about Charlie and his dogs, you can go over to iditaradmusher.com.
Right. And I think I know the answer to that story. I think it was when GB Jones had the kennel, and he's been a musher for a long time. And I think he had that website domain back in the days of the early internet, you know, the early 2000s when the internet boom really came on board. And I believe, I may be mistaken here, that Charlie took over sort of some of the operations from GB Jones's kennel at that time, and he was fortunate enough to snag that domain name. What a search engine optimization for Charlie and his kennel to have that, because anybody that is searching for Iditarod is likely to put in, you know, the Google search bar or whatever, Iditarod Musher Charlie, Iditarod Musher Jeff, Iditarod Musher Anna, whatever, and that's going to pop up first page results for Charlie's kennel. I think that's a heck of a marketing opportunity for sure. Alex, I know we're way over time here, and I've got to get ready for my first race here of the year with Team Inecce, just a short 20-miler that's happening in about an hour. So I've got to get busy. Anything you need to say in closing?
No, just that we'll be back tomorrow and sort of wrapping up the Iditarod one last time while they're at the banquet. And have fun on your race, and I'm sure the dogs will do really, really well.
I hope so. Good luck to everybody out there getting home from Nome over the next couple of days now that we've told our airport story. Hope nothing goes awry there. I hope everybody that is in Nome is going to enjoy the banquet. And, Alex, I'll talk to you tomorrow, okay?
Okay. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We'll see you guys tomorrow for our last day of the 2018 coverage here on Mushing Radio of the Iditarod. Goodbye.